CBS Eye on the World, I'm John Batchelor. Patrick O'Donnell, his new book, The Indispensables, the diverse soldier mariners who shaped the country, formed the Navy, and rode Washington across the Delaware. Right now, we want to discover Marblehead, about 18 miles to the northeast of Boston, on the water, and it is a prosperous town in the 18th century. Patrick, you estimate about 5,000. Its business was fishing. What was its relation to Boston and Massachusetts' economy?
It's the second largest port city in Massachusetts, and it's a thriving cosmopolitan city. And its fortunes are made on fish, specifically codfish. And the men of Marblehead fish the Grand Banks. This is, you know, well over 1,000 miles to the north up near Nova Scotia. But the Grand Banks are teeming with codfish, in some cases, which are, you know, 100 pounds or more, John. And they fish the Grand Banks, bring back the cod, and then they trade the cod, which they put in salted barrels for other goods. And they have a massive merchant fleet that they've developed where they trade around the world and bring goods in and out of Marblehead.
In 1774, October of 1774, Marblehead obeys the orders, the directions, the guidelines of the Massachusetts Provincial Congress to form a militia. These are the Minutemen that are at Lexington and Concord. Each town is to have its own militia, and Patrick's reporting, about 50, with sergeants and lieutenants and colonels. That becomes the core of the Marblehead Regiment that will spend years as parts of the Continental Army. Important to introduce some of the players here. Colonel Jeremiah Lee and Lieutenant John Glover. I'm going to key on Glover because it's a discovery to me to meet John Glover. What is he in 1774, Patrick?
John Glover starts out, he's a self-made man, John, and a very wealthy self-made man. About 5'3", stocky, red-haired, very scrappy. Begins life as a cobbler. Does shoes and fishes as well, but builds up enough money to build a bar, which is extremely successful, and he buys his first ship, and then it's one ship after another from there, and he builds a fleet of ships, fishing ships as well as trading ships. And John Glover is a self-made man. They respect self-made individuals in Marblehead. And Marblehead has some of the wealthiest men in the colonies. And they are part of this regiment that's forming, this militia group. Jeremiah Lee, for instance, is considered one of the wealthiest men in the 13th colonies, and just enormous wealth. And it's matched with his waistline. He's just a rotund guy, nearly 300 pounds. But he's also extremely wealthy and extremely influential. And these men are part of the Massachusetts Provisional Government. And some of the key committees are all chaired, or they are the key members of these committees, which are the levers of power prior to the Revolutionary War. A lot of decisions are made. They're bringing in gunpowder supplies, for instance. They're bringing in cannon through their trade routes, which they convert into supply lines. They have key relationships with the King of Spain and the trading families in Spain, which are our first foreign aid in 1774.
The formation of the Marblehead Minutemen includes men of color who are part of the fishing fleet. Patrick follows the stories that we have today, Manuel Soto, Caesar Glover, Romeo. Other names come and go through the course of the war, part of the Marblehead unit, because they sail together, they fight together. And we're going to put them immediately into the fight for powder. It's about powder. The British understand that depriving powder ends the possibility of revolt. Patrick identifies the raid on Fort William and Mary, a powder bivouac of the British Army. It's in the Piscataway River, which is between now New Hampshire and Maine. At that point, Maine was part of Massachusetts. Between New Hampshire and Maine, and it's an island called Newcastle Island. This is December 14th, 1774. It's led by a man named John Langdon, participating as the Marbleheader and sailor Winborne Adams. What is the result of their raid, Patrick? Is it successful?
It is, John. Fort William and Mary is a decrepit, it's hard to even call it a fort in 1774, but it was a main powder source for the British Army. And they also had a number of cannon there. And the Marbleheaders, through their intelligence, tip off the folks up in near Portsmouth that the British are coming to seize the powder. And they they basically mount a raid. John Sullivan is in the lead along with Langdon. They assemble a mob of several hundred men, and they storm the fort. And it's quite an interesting story because inside the fort are five, I wouldn't call them redcoats. They're actually Americans that are in the employ of the crown. And they try to resist, and they fire several shots. These are the first shots of the American Revolution. A couple of men are wounded. The cannon is fired. They storm the walls and they seize the powder. But before that, there's a lot of really interesting dynamics. There's first woman that's a loyalist combatant that hands the pistols to her husband to defend themselves. There's a lot of intrigue that goes on, but they eventually seize the powder and the cannon. They conduct two raids just before Crown reinforcements under General Gage arrive.
That powder becomes critical. It's distributed throughout the hands of the patriots. They call themselves, many of them are either Sons of Liberty or sympathetic to the Sons of Liberty. At the same time, there are loyalists among them. And I mentioned there was a purge of the loyalists at the Marblehead Regiment before. The loyalists, however, can easily disguise themselves being part of the communities. So, Patrick, in your telling, I see very clearly we can call this a revolution, but it's also a civil war between factions who live together.
It's very much a civil war. It's a raging civil war. And many characters in this book are targeted. The main character in my book, or one of them, is Dr. Nathaniel Bond. And Dr. Bond is a virus specialist, but during the Battle of Lexington and Concord, which we talked about, he treated British soldiers. And for that, he was canceled. And what I mean by that is they felt that he was a loyalist after doing that. It's just following his Hippocratic oath, but he treated these British soldiers. His house was surrounded. And I own the original letter that Dr. Bond wrote to Elbridge Gerry demanding, my house is surrounded. There's thousands of people that have threatened to kill me. If you don't send an armed guard immediately, I'll be dead tomorrow. And they do that, and he asks for a court-martial, and he presents the evidence of what he did, which was nothing wrong, and he was exonerated. But that's the level of – there's lots of political violence in this book. There's a lot of cancel culture, if you will, things that are – part of the civil war that is taking place.
And that civil war will not be resolved. The loyalists have as much claim on the land and their property as the apparent rebels. In fact, repeatedly in the contest, and Patrick quotes from what we have, the sources at the time, the redcoats were routinely encouraged to call the people they were attacking rebels, not Englishmen, rebels, which explains why they bayoneted them to death, even though they'd surrendered. There was genuine enmity and hatred between the British regulars. These are first-rate troops, and the Marbleheaders and their colleagues. When we come back, Bunker Hill and Marbleheaders. Patrick O'Donnell, the book is The Indispensables. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.